Hello, listeners. This is Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, we're going to talk about why the president seemed so psyched earlier this week on national TV about the prospect of a government shutdown, something presidents typically expend a lot of energy and political capital trying to avoid. We're also going to talk about how he's potentially entering into this moment dealing with an ascendant Nancy Pelosi, who just this week took additional steps to secure another couple years as Speaker of the House. Plus, help wanted at the White House. We're going to dive into the search for a chief of staff, and we're going to talk about why that matters for Trump's re-election campaign, his response to the Mueller investigation, and a whole host of other things that you would expect a chief of staff to be able to help him out with. But as we're going to talk about, is maybe not the way things work in Trump's White House. Remember, stick around for the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. And as always, remember that we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday. That's December 13th. So it's all up to date as of then. Okay, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We have a member of our congressional team on the line from the Capitol, Rachel Bade. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hey there.
Thank you so much for joining us. And in the studio, we have a member of our White House team, Andrew Restuccia. Andrew, hello.
Hey.
All right, let's jump right into our first data point, 8 days to go until a partial shutdown of the federal government, unless Congress and the White House can figure out some sort of deal to keep things funded and keep the wheels of government spinning as they are supposed to. Let's dive right in. So, Andrew, lead us off here with the White House view on this. Does President Donald Trump want a government shutdown? He seemed pretty excited about the prospect when the cameras were on him with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in the Oval Office earlier this week.
I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck.
Yeah, I mean, this is another example of Trump saying out loud something that he's been sort of saying privately for months and months and months. I mean, like, Trump's basic logic here is that for him, a shutdown isn't necessarily bad politics when you look at it through the lens solely of his conservative base. And so the president has basically made the calculation that, you know, border security, building the wall is the very thing that I based my entire presidential campaign on. And so if I abandon that in some way, or if I look weak on that, it's going to hurt me with the people that, you know, I need going into 2020. So he's basically said, you know, $5 billion or nothing. And he made that explicit in this sort of remarkable meeting earlier this week with Pelosi and Schumer, in which they were sort of talking over each other and arguing. And, you know, Trump basically said, you know, I will own this. I will happily shut down the government over wall funding. And so the big question is, if we get to that point, who's going to blink first? And I'm sure Rachel has lots of thoughts on that.
Yeah, Rachel, tell us about the congressional perspective here. Like, what's going on? Why is this held up? Where, you know, where specifically is the impasse coming from?
Yeah, it's the border wall, just as Andrew was saying right there. I mean, Democrats right now, they're sort of feeling energized and heartened from the midterm elections, especially House Democrats, where they picked up 40 seats in early November. And they're saying they are not going to give Trump, you know, a penny of what he wants. He wants $5 billion. House Democrats don't want to even give him, you know, anything on this. Schumer, on the other side of the Capitol, has said he will be fine with continuing government funding for, he calls it the fence, technically it is a fence, for next year as it was last year. So that's about $1.3 billion. So Democrats are not going to come above $1.3, and they're making that clear. The problem is that Republicans, while they don't want to do this, and it's so funny to hear their dread here, a lot of people are not excited about the prospect of being here on Christmas, but they are not going to do anything without Trump's permission, because Trump will blast them and he will turn on them, and they know that. And so they don't have the will to stand up against the president, and so they are following his lead right now. So I do think he's put them in a pickle, because a lot of times when we have a government shutdown, the question is, whose fault is it? And what Trump did in this meeting was he said, okay, it'll be my fault. I'm going to do it. I'm going to shut the government down. And Democrats were really excited about that, because, you know, now no one can argue that they're to blame. Trump is the one saying, I need something. I need this money for my wall. And if I don't get it, we're going to, you know, cause all this chaos and shut the government down.
Well, and the thing that really struck me about that is that Trump was saying, I'll take the blame, right? But the, like, probably the biggest lesson that we just learned from the midterm elections and from all the special elections over the past year and everything else from the past couple of years is that Trump isn't just Trump anymore. Trump is the Republican Party at this point. And a lot of House Republicans lost who had otherwise in the past survived tough years for the GOP because of Donald Trump. And a lot of these House Republicans know that, right? But they are not about to come out. They're, like you said, they're in a pickle, right? They can't come out and say that because they know that Trump will go nuclear on them.
That's exactly right. And I would just say, you know, to add to that, that Republicans convinced the president to hold off on this shutdown fight. He wanted to do it in October. And they said, no, if we shut down the government just weeks before Election Day, it's going to hurt us even more in the midterms. And so they have been promising the president, we are going to have this fight. He's been itching for this fight for a long time. So they postponed it till after the election. And now they're really reluctant to go through with it, but they can't. There's nothing they can do with that, short of Trump changing his mind, and then the headline becomes Trump folds, which he will hate. They're going to have to go through with this.
Andrew?
Yeah, and I think this is another example of Trump being totally out for himself politically, right? This is what he views as a key to his own political survival. And he frankly like isn't thinking about or and frankly doesn't seem to care about how this will affect, you know, Republicans in the House and elsewhere generally. The president is, you know, once again out for himself.
How could this resolve? Is there any way it could resolve without a government shutdown, or are we just kind of barreling towards this with no safety, no off ramp in sight?
It feels like a lot of people have kind of lost hope in this. I was talking to a senior leadership Republican just last night, and said person was hopeful that we would be out on Christmas, but has lost all hope of, and that was just a couple days ago, as of last night, has lost all hope and thinks the government will probably be shut down through the beginning of next year. And so that what that means is when Democrats take the House, the first thing that Nancy Pelosi is going to be able to do as Speaker is have this vote to reopen the government. And at that point, the government will potentially have been shut down for a couple weeks, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on Mitch McConnell to also approve and bring up for a vote and pass whatever bill Pelosi puts on the floor. So the pressure will then move to McConnell, who hates government shutdowns. He's a former appropriator. He knows how bad it is, and he doesn't want to do this. And so that's going to put Republicans once again in a pickle, trying to decide between what's the responsible thing to do here, or are we going to defy, you know, our leadership in the White House?
And then it'll be up to the president ultimately to decide whether he finds whatever compromise they come up with acceptable.
Right.
And that's a big question mark, right? Because again, he doesn't want to look like, as you said, Rachel, like he's giving in or he's folding.
And
yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Rachel.
I was just going to say one thing on this that's interesting. You know, with government shutdowns, typically the person making the demand gets the blame. For instance, the last shutdown we had earlier this year, Chuck Schumer and the Democrats were demanding a fix for DACA, for Dreamers who came here as children illegally by their parents, finding a way so that they wouldn't be deported and their lives totally uprooted. Well, Schumer and the Democrats got a lot of pushback on that. And so the thinking, at least, is traditionally would be that the president would sort of pay politically for this. But again, this is Trump. And I am sort of interested to see how this goes for him and his poll numbers, because he has defied, you know, political gravity before. And we'll just have to see if he has the blowback that a traditional politician would have, or if it just excites the base even more and, you know,
yeah,
goes the opposite direction.
Yeah, I think that, like, it's certainly unclear how exactly this is going to play. But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, the people that dislike Trump dislike him heavily already, right? And so this isn't going to change any minds for the most part. What it will do and what it could do is, as you said, Rachel, excite his actual base. And that those are really the only people that he's focused on at the moment.
I will say also, I mean, it seems like there's a chance that the so-called resistance right now is kind of at a low ebb, right? Like they maybe like sated, right, with the, you know, their Thanksgiving turkey and getting ready for the holidays. They just won a big election, right? But You could imagine this being the sort of thing in advance of the presidential election really heating up that kind of gets the juices flowing again.
But let's also keep in mind that, you know, by the time you know, we get to 2020, this will be a distant memory,
to
say the least.
Right. No.
There will be 3,000 scandals.
I'm thinking more of, you know, the continuum, right? Like, this leads into whatever the next outrage is, kind of leads into a bunch of candidates jumping in 2019. Anyway, Rachel, I want to jump over to something that you mentioned a couple minutes ago, and the fact that this is all happening while Republicans still have full control of the House, which they're not going to have in a few more weeks, right? Once the new Congress is sworn in and Democrats take over, and at that point, Trump is not dealing with Paul Ryan as Speaker. He's dealing with, it looks like, I mean, it, more and more certain, Nancy Pelosi as Speaker. And we were talking about that kind of fiery meeting that Trump had in the Oval Office with Pelosi and Schumer that was live on TV for all to see. And she is now dealing with him from an increasing point of strength, not just with regard to the election results, but in terms of her prospects of holding power within the House. Can you tell us a little bit about the latest developments there and why Pelosi has a stronger hand probably than she's ever had in dealing with Trump at this point?
Yeah, there was a deal that was struck where Pelosi was able to secure the support of some of her hardline critics. These are people who, for the past 2 months, have sworn that they are going to vote against her on the House floor on January 3rd. Now, during that vote, she needs 218 votes to be Speaker. And there was a group for a long time of about 16 Democrats who said they were not going to vote for her. And this was not including a number of incoming freshmen who also say they were not going to vote for her. She could only lose about 16 to 18 votes. And so they were threatening to keep her from the gavel by banding together and voting for somebody else on the floor. But what happened this week was she sort of struck this deal where she promised that she is essentially not going to serve as Speaker beyond the year 2022. These rebels came up with this idea that Democratic leadership from now on is going to have term limits. They can only serve for 4 terms. And since Pelosi has already served as Speaker in this position, two of her terms are done, which means she can only serve this term, coming term in 2019. And then if she tries to serve again, she has a higher threshold that she has to meet for that 4th term. So basically,
in terms of internal caucus support.
Yes. It's going to be harder for her to serve that 4th term, essentially. So what she's done is she's put a time limit on her speakership. And what that does for the rebels is it gives them something to hold up to say, we got something. We are now looking at the future of Democratic leadership. We know she's going to be out the door eventually. And so we're going to back Pelosi so that Democrats can unify into the new Congress going forward. Now, obviously, their initial goal was to drive her out this Congress, and they failed to do that. So, but this shows she's going to have the votes to become Speaker in January, which is going to help her in terms of negotiating with the president.
And Andrew, what's the White House view on all this? I mean, it seems like this week was kind of a preview of what we're going to be watching for a lot of the next couple years of Pelosi back in the speakership, taking a front row seat in these negotiations with Donald Trump and maybe getting the better of him sometimes. And this was interesting. You know, you'd think Trump has this reputation as a showman, right, of like the public performance. And it was interesting to see Pelosi kind of standing up to him in that sense, as opposed to like the backroom dealing that she is most renowned for. But it just seemed to me like a preview of the next couple of years that we were all watching play out.
Yeah, definitely it is. The president expected to open up this, what was at the time, a closed press meeting with the three of them. And Mike Pence was also there, though he didn't say a word. And bring the press in and basically walk all over Schumer and Pelosi.
Kind of rock them on their heels, right?
Exactly. Like, and then that's obviously not at all what happened. The president, I'm told, was quite frustrated after the meeting because he felt like it didn't go his way, at least in terms of public perception. The White House views Pelosi as a formidable, you know, opponent. And the other factor here is that Trump and Pelosi, or Trump at least, likes Pelosi, you know, behind the scenes. He despite the fact that he spent the entire midterm, you know, run up to the midterms, you know, trashing her, you know, every chance he got. Like, they have, you know, from what I'm told from White House officials, like a decent rapport behind the scenes, probably not something that either of them want out there. he you know, has a long history with Chuck Schumer going back to New York, but I was told that, like, he'd rather deal with Pelosi, you know, if given the choice. So there
that's really interesting to me because, you know, she came back to the Hill after that White House meeting and literally trashed him,
ripped him apart
privately in a room full of Democrats, saying, you know, basically questioning his manhood. And we all know how sensitive Trump is about his manhood and the size of his hands, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, and saying, you know, she was trying to be the mom, and you get, what was it? The quote is, you get into a tinkle she says, I was trying to be the mom, but it goes to show, you get into a tinkle contest with a skunk, you get tinkled all over you. literally, just like...
But Trump sort of respects that kind of thing, right? It's like the same tactic that he would use in that same scenario. And he has this sort of habit of being able to rip people apart publicly and have them do the same, but then, like, behind closed doors, like, sort of joke with them and have build a relationship. That's not to say their relationship's going to be perfect going forward, but it's definitely something to watch.
I think what you are saying, though, is that it's going to be fascinating to watch. And it's going to be really, I have a feeling we're going to end up talking about this more and more in future shows. All right, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. Andrew, I know you're sticking around, but Rachel, I'll let you get back to business up there on the Capitol.
All right, chasing away. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to welcome in Nancy Cook from our White House team. Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
And Nancy is here to talk through our next data point, which is the number 3. President Trump is heading into his third year in office, looking for his third chief of staff. It's the big story out of the White House this week, besides, you know, the impending government shutdown, after the president said the current chief of staff, John Kelly, would leave at the end of the year, and after Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff, Nick Ayers, turned down the job that everyone had been expecting for a while he was going to step into. So now it's wide open, coming into a really critical point of Trump's presidency. You've got the presidential election approaching. You've got the government shutting down. You've got all sorts of investigation. You've got, you know, the Mueller investigation and House Democratic investigations into not just him, but other parts of his administration. There's going to be a lot going on. So that said, maybe we're all looking at this backwards. Nancy, does Donald Trump need a chief of staff?
I mean, I think he views himself as his own chief of staff, also own communications director, own best political strategist. And so I think he is most comfortable with the model that he's had throughout his business career, where he has, like, a very, very trusted secretary or executive assistant who, like, takes his calls, and then he kind of runs everything. And he does have that set up in the White House. He has an executive assistant named Madeline who sits outside of his office. But that's always the structure that he's had in the business world, and that's what he seems most comfortable with.
You mentioned at one point on a previous show, instead of, like, an organizational chart, like a pyramid structure, there's a wheel with spokes all leading into the center in Trump's kind of perfect world vision of how things should be.
Yeah, and he's the hub, and that's how he has always liked it, and that's how he feels comfortable. The problem is that running the federal government is obviously an enormous task. You know, you have the cabinet members, you have national security concerns, economic ones. You know, we have basically two wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan and have had those for years. You know, there's sort of every day there's, like, big policy decisions that have to be made. You have to plan for the future. He has to look ahead to the reelection campaign. He has to think about how the White House is going to react to the Mueller investigation. And it's such a big job that traditionally the chief of staff basically comes in every day and helps you organize your time, you know, helps make sure that you have time to think about things, organizes, like, all the paper on your desk. I mean, it makes it sound like it's just an organization and logistical job, but that's such a key thing because the president is pulled in so many directions. And that's what Trump has resisted so far, sort of empowering someone to actually do that. And it's very hard to run the federal government, you know, like a family business with just, like, a few aides and a loose structure when the federal government, there's so many billions of dollars at stake, so many jobs, and also, like, the democracy, right?
Right. Well, and also in that kind of situation, you get staff freelancing, right, Andrew, which we've seen at times over the last 2 years, I think especially before John Kelly came in as White House Chief of Staff, where there was just all sorts of chaos going on at the staff level within the White House.
Right. I mean, traditionally, the Chief of Staff role has been more of a gatekeeper type role. Trump doesn't want his gates to be kept by anybody, right? I mean, he wants have free reign over the people that he talks to and meets with. And to some extent, like, that is, you know, that's not going to change, right? Like, no matter who he brings in. And the chief of staff role has also been sort of a more traditionally been more of a behind the scenes type role. But we're told that, you know, the president really wants his next chief of staff to be sort of a more out front figure, especially heading into the 2020 reelection, a person that has kind of a aggressive fighter style approach to the job, which is why there's been so much buzz around the president's former deputy campaign manager, David Bossie, as one potential candidate. I mean, he's someone that Trump likes very much. Personally, there will be quite a bit of resistance to him being brought in to the role from others in the White House, who kind of look upon Bossie with a huge amount of skepticism. But the president likes these sort of sweepstakes, like, who's it going to be? He likes to keep people guessing. He says that he's talking to dozens of people about this job, and he loves the idea that people are coming to him and want to do this, despite the fact that we know that there are a lot of people who don't want this job because there's a past history of these people being dragged across the coals and their reputations being tarnished.
And for that, I say thank you. Next, thank you. Next, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, people this week, you know, at the beginning of this week or Sunday, actually, when Andrew and I were working, you know, basically, you know, two cabinet members were in the running. Their names were floated. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who has a very close relationship with Ivanka and Jared and worked on the campaign. You know, people close to him were signaling to me he didn't want it. You know, he wants to stay at Treasury. Same thing happened with OMB Director Mick Mulvaney, who just this summer was campaigning for it. You know, we were hearing strong signals on Sunday night that he also didn't want it. So, like, you know, Trump keeps saying everybody wants the job, like, this is the most amazing job. But that's just not the reality. There's like two people that want the job, and it's not even clear that they're qualified or that they'll get it. And so we may end up seeing, you know, sort of a totally out of left field dark horse candidate.
And we should note also that Mark Meadows, the other Freedom Caucus chairman, the other leading contender for the job, is now not getting the job either. The White House insists that it was all Trump's doing, that Trump sort of, you know, out of the goodness of his own heart said, you should stay in Congress, I need you there. But, you know, those are three, you know, top candidates that in the last few days have all basically pulled out of the running.
And it should be noted, like, this used to be, you know, one of the most powerful jobs in Washington, being the gatekeeper to the Oval Office, to the president. You know, past chiefs of staff, you know, you see them as talking heads on TV. You know, Ken Duberstein, who was Reagan's chief of staff for a short period of time, has a big lobbying firm.
Rahm Emanuel, mayor of Chicago.
Right. It's like, right, you go on to become, like, you know, either lucrative private sector jobs or sort of big other jobs in Washington, or, you know, you can kind of write your ticket. And it says so much about the Trump White House that, like, nobody wants this job, which used to be the job that everybody in Washington wanted.
How much of that has to do with, and I guess a fair amount has to do with Trump and the way he envisions the White House being run, but some of it has to do with what the incoming chief of staff is going to have to deal with, right? In terms of you've got to manage, liaise with the reelection campaign. You're going to be dealing with investigation after investigation from Congress into cabinet agencies and the White House. You're going to have the Mueller investigation. You're going to, you know, we could go on, right?
We could go on. And also, like, the White House really hasn't been preparing for these things. And so whoever takes a job, it's not just like that they're coming into, you know, a firestorm coming in from multiple battlefronts. It's also that the White House, like, doesn't really have a plan to deal with these things. And so you would have to come in, and in addition to dealing with, like, Trump's idiosyncrasies and his preferred management style, which is very little management, you would also have to, like, very quickly strategically decide, like, how are we going from this White House that's worked with just this largely Republicans the first 2 years to, like, basically being under siege. And you'd have to come up with a plan quickly and, like, probably hire some people to deal with that. It's a lot to ask someone.
And I think that's partly why you're seeing some of these top candidates emerging who are sort of these more politically minded, sort of aggressive in the trenches folks versus these sort of, like, establishment Republican types who, you know, have a system for how a chief of staff job should work and how each piece should fit together, right?
I mean, you mentioned David Bossie, who was the deputy campaign manager. Who else has kind of emerged as a possibility since Nick Ayers, speaking of politically minded operative types?
Yeah,
has
I mean,
out.
You name it, right? Like, there's been everyone from Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, Matt Whitaker, the current acting attorney general, who Trump likes quite a bit. Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, who has also sort of signaled maybe he's not quite interested. Who else, Nancy? There's so many names.
I mean, I think the front runners, the people to watch, are basically Matt Whitaker. Trump attended the Army and Navy game last weekend with a bunch of top aides. He sat next to Whitaker for a long time, I was told. You know, he's told people on a bunch of occasions he loves Matt Whitaker. So my money is on Matt Whitaker and Bossie. However, I feel like just by saying that out loud, that means that it's not going to be either of them. Like,
it's a butterfly effect.
Andrew, exactly. Andrew and I were writing a story last week about how it was definitely going to be Nick Ayers, which was true.
Like, it was at
the time. And I called a former White House official and I said, oh, you know, I'm writing this story on Nick Ayers. And this person said, you know, I've gotten so many calls from White House reporters today and you all are going to write the story. And I'm like 100% sure now, because it's out there, it's not going to happen.
Lo and behold.
Yeah,
I mean, it is true that Trump likes to keep people guessing, and he sort of revels in this, you know, who's it going to be thing. And it also, you know, for him, it's a much needed, despite the fact that he's very sensitive to the notion that no one wants this job, he likes to talk about chief of staff, and it's a distraction from all the other stuff that he's having to deal with, right?
Yeah, and this has been, let's just put it out there, a bad week for him. You know, his former fixer yesterday was sentenced to 3 years in prison. You know what's a good way to change the subject from that? The chief of staff sweepstakes.
Well, we saw this a few weeks ago, right? We saw the really bad midterm election results for him. And then what's the headline of the papers the next day after that? It's Jeff Sessions out at the Justice Department,
right?
I mean, we were marveling on the show that week about how if you just looked at the front page of all the big national papers, it was like the election had not happened a couple days before, because there was so much to deal with in terms of what was going on in the cabinet and inside the White House.
And I do think, like, as reporters, we need to be careful about overemphasizing, you know, these sort of personnel issues in lieu of, you know, the sort of big picture things that are happening right now, which is really, you know, the Russia probe and it nearing closer and closer and closer to the president. That being said, it doesn't hurt to talk about personnel every now and then. We love it at Politico.
Well, I think the important thing about it is, right, how does this affect the way that Trump is able to handle it? And I think the general picture that's emerging is that there's no plan. There's no one. Even if there was a plan, there's no one to implement it.
Yeah, I think Kelly was starting to think about it, but then you know, now he's leaving. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, who's going to be thinking about it?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be like, in, you know, no chief of staff, whoever it is going to come in and fundamentally change who the president is. But they could take sort of, you know, incremental steps to prepare for what we all know is coming over the next couple months. And the question, as Nancy said, is anyone going to be ready to do that?
Well, we'll find out soon. It will probably be someone no one's ever heard of based on what you told me.
Maybe it'll be one of us.
All right. Andrew, thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Nancy, great to see you as always.
Oh, thanks, Scott.
All right. As promised, at the end here, we're going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan. Victor Benjamin of London in the United Kingdom is going to help us out with the credits this week.
Nerdcast is produced by Michaela Rodriguez with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Victor. Listeners, we found Victor because he emailed to say he was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, please let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.